No. Where the sound is not? Oh, okay, it is now. Okay, thank you. Go ahead.
All right. Can you hear me now? All right. Added item on closed session is pending litigation. Number 7, Los Osos Community Services District versus Julie Rodewall. Number 8 is Dresser versus County of San Luis Obispo et al. All requirements of the Brown Act have been satisfied as this notice was posted prior to the 72-hour noticing requirement. Withdrawn items presentation, item A-1-B, presentation of a resolution proclaiming August 2005 as the Clark Center Volunteer Appreciation Month. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign. Staff is requesting this item be withdrawn and brought back at a later date. Amended item consent, number B-10, request to approve, 1, the creation of a new project for the preservation of the Royos Caldona,
Rios
Adobe, Riodonia, thank you, Adobe, WBS, number 350014, 2, a budget adjustment in the amount of $394,442 from unanticipated revenue, 3, acceptance of grant funding for the project, and 4, authorizing the General Services Director to negotiate and sign grant contracts to complete the project. Recommend approval and instruct Chairperson to sign. Staff is requesting the cover sheet be amended to reflect the item 3 is a resolution accepting grant funding for the project. Those are all the changes for today.
Thank you very much. The next item is
presentation.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Asagi?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovid?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. Our first presentation, Mr. Ovid.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to call Dennis Maresco up the podium. I asked Patty, his wife, if she'd like to come up. She's going to just let Dennis take care of it this time. So. It gives me privilege to read the resolution honoring Dennis for his induction in the California Building Industry Hall of Fame. And I just happened to come across this by reading one of the industrial magazines. And I really wanted to put this on the agenda because I think Dennis, along with many others, represent people we really don't honor that basically not only professionally but get involved in the communities. And so with this, the following resolution is hereby read. Whereas Dennis Maresco has been awarded the statewide honor of being inducted into the California Building Industries Foundation Hall of Fame. And whereas Dennis has lived and worked in San Luis Obispo since 1975, where he received a degree in architecture from Cal Poly, where Dennis and his wife Patty own Midland Pacific Homes, whose policy is to build quality homes that stand the test of time, to sell the homes to individuals and families, which improves and builds communities. And whereas Dennis and his wife Patty co-founded a charitable Midland Pacific Foundation in 2004 that, among other things, has contributed to the youth programs in San Miguel. And now, therefore, be it resolved that the County of San Luis Obispo Board of Supervisors, State of California, does hereby recognize and honor Dennis Maresco and Patty for their contributions to the improving San Luis Obispo County and for his induction into the California Building Industry Hall of Fame. Dennis?
Thank you.
And would you care to say a few words, Dennis?
Sure. Missed this opportunity. It's been quite an honor. I have received a letter from the governor. I have received a resolution from the state of California legislature. But nothing means more to me than this. This is where I started my career before this body. I was trying to remember what chamber it was in, because it was before the one that was across the street, and this is the first time I've been in this one. I can't remember, but I really appreciate it. I have been very, very fortunate to do what I do in San Luis Obispo County, and a place I love. It's a beautiful place, probably one of the best places on earth. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Lenthal, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Would Jeanette Pell and Kim Barrett please stand up there at the podium? Or would you like to go to opposite podiums? First, I want to say that as somebody that spent a lifetime in law enforcement, I'm very, very proud of these two ladies here. What we're reading this morning is a board resolution commending the probation department and information technology upon receiving the Most Innovative Use of Technology Award from the Center of Digital Government and Handheld Electronic Rulebook. Whereas San Luis Obispo County was presented the Best of California Award, established to salute professionals in California for their dedicated hard work and contributions, and whereas San Luis Obispo County was recognized for Most Innovative Use of Technology, Best Application Serving the Public for Handheld Electronic Route Book, and for those of us that are technologically challenged, they call that HERB. Whereas this system allows probation officers to instantly access probationers' court order terms and conditions from anywhere in the community, quickly take notes in the field, access photographs of probationers for allied law enforcement agencies and community corrections through identification use of personal digital assistants or PDAs, and share this information with others in the department, usually within 24 hours of a home visit to a probationer. And whereas the desktop application is available to all staff within the department, gives access to officers' field notes at all times. And whereas the application provided tracking and sharing of vital probationer information such as officer safety issues, probationer contact history, and compliance to terms, conditions imposed on a case-by-case basis. Whereas the application resulted in cost savings to the county. And whereas all of this has led to greater community safety in that probationers are held to a higher level of supervision and accountability. Now, therefore, be it resolved and ordered by the Board of Supervisors, County of San Luis Obispo, State of California, that the Probation and Information Technology Departments be and hereby are commended for receiving this award. And these two ladies played a real major part of this, and that's why I'm very, very proud of them and their departments. Thank you. And I hope they're going to explain everything that these do in 2 minutes or less.
Absolutely. I'll let them have three.
I just want to say thank you for this recognition. I am proud to represent the Information Technology Department today, but specifically I'd like to recognize Brian Lopez, the designer and the programmer for this application. And it's just a pleasure to support our customers. Thank you.
The Probation Department also thanks Information Technology. Obviously, we couldn't have made this happen without them. This is an efficiency measure that has made a great difference for our probation officers out in the field. When you have between 100 and 150 cases, and you're out in the field trying to document everything that you're doing, HERB is a great friend to have. So thank you. And I also would like to thank Brian Lopez from Information Technology, and Dan Maddich with the Probation Department, who really made this happen. Thank you again.
And thank you. Cacho, you're next.
Thank you, Madam Chair. It's always a pleasure to honor our staff and volunteers. From our Gulf, it would be Mr. Leib, Mr. Jenny. Would you gentlemen, either one of you, come forward and introduce the rest of the volunteers and committee members? While you're coming forward, let me start reading it. It's quite an honor to read this resolution commending Gator Creek Golf Course staff and County Parks Resource Advisory Committee for their work in achieving certified Audubon Cooperative Sanctuary status for Gator Creek Golf Course. Whereas golf courses represent both a significant recreational asset and a potentially valuable source of wildlife habitat if properly managed. And whereas County Parks Golf Course Superintendent Ray Festa, his staff, and the volunteer members of the Parks Resource Advisory Committee have undertaken a series of steps to enhance the habitat values of both Morro Bay and Dairy Creek Golf Course. And whereas, through the efforts of staff and volunteers, the quality of play at Dairy Creek Golf Course has been maintained while significantly improving its resource values by carefully managing water and chemical use and providing increased food, shelter, and water for wildlife. And whereas, That program will result in more environmentally sensitive practices at Dairy Creek Golf Course, and whereas, through the efforts of staff and volunteers, the goal and designation of Certified Audubon Cooperative Sanctuary was first achieved at Morro Bay Golf Course in 1995, and now being achieved at Dairy Creek Golf Course. Now, therefore, be it resolved that the Board of Supervisors and the Department of General Services commend Golf Course Superintendent Ray Festa, his staff at Dairy Creek Golf Course, and the members of the Resource Advisory Committee for their selfless efforts to enhance county-operated golf courses. Gentlemen, congratulations. If you come forward, accept this resolution. Mr. Jenny, if you'll introduce the gentleman for us, and if they wish to say a word yourself, you're welcome to do so.
I'm Pete Jenny, Parks Manager. I'm going to turn it over to our Golf Superintendent, Ray Festa, while I prepare to push some buttons and show you a brief presentation on the program.
Okay.
I'm John Evans, a retired county director for the University of California Cooperative Extension and also chair of the County Golf Courses Resource Committee. And on behalf of all the golfers at Dairy Creek and all the hardworking staff, Russ Kroc out there and his leadership, I would like to accept this on behalf of all these people. Thank you.
I wondered what you'd been doing in your spare time, John. I know.
Good morning, and thank you for this extended opportunity for us to present a little bit more about this program that we're doing at Dairy Creek and also at Morro Bay Golf Course. I wanted to also acknowledge the work of the staff at Dairy Creek, particularly Russ Kroc, our golf course supervisor, and all of his staff that's done an outstanding job, and also the core of volunteers that we have who works with us as a resource committee. We have 6 volunteers from the community who bring their specific expertise to help staff and guide us in the direction of this program. The program we're talking about this morning is called the Audubon Cooperative Sanctuary Program for Golf Courses. It was created by an agency or an organization called Audubon International that's headquartered in Selkirk, New York. It was founded in 1990, and the program is specifically designed to help golf course operators learn how to manage their properties in a much more environmentally sensitive manner. All golf courses in the country are encouraged to participate in the program. The program is underwritten by all the major golf organizations and professional associations. Statewide, we have over 1,000 golf courses enrolled in the program. As the presentation we're going to see will show, there are 33 now that have received fully certification, and Morro Bay and Dairy Creek are 2 of the 33. So we're very proud of that. It's quite an accomplishment. Our presentation this morning is going to be a 12-minute PowerPoint presentation, which is going to kind of take you through the various aspects of the program and some of the projects that we've accomplished. And at the end of that presentation, I'll be available to answer questions, as will John, entertain questions, and anything else you'd like to know. So without any further ado, if we can launch it, and we'll sit back and watch. Thank you.
There's a technology, we have no sound.
Works
Before I turn the mic over to John, I'd like to just point out that this PowerPoint demonstration was put together by one of our volunteers on our resource committee. This is the kind of quality contributions we've gotten from the community. It's just outstanding. And particularly John's leadership for the last 12 years as a chairman of our golf course resource committee. He's given us great guidance and wisdom, and his expertise, his lifelong career in education has been invaluable to us. So we really appreciate the contributions of John and all of our volunteers. Thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Ray. I would like to recognize people.
And you do have to give your name again for the record, John.
Pardon?
You do have to give your name again.
Oh, yes. Not everyone knows John Evans, do they? John Evans, longtime county director and farm advisor for the University of California Cooperative Extension. I appeared before the board many, many times. The digs that my grandchildren would say have changed, but some of the people up there haven't. Okay. What I would like to do in my work with Cooperative Extension, I work with many volunteers, and that was the fun part of my work, just working with these people, very dedicated people, people who are willing to give their time and effort on behalf of the county at no cost to the county. And these are really fine people. And the people on our committee, I wanted to just kind of recognize them. One was Susie Benskin. She was our only woman representative, but she was a docent at the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History and was in charge of the outreach program, this is part of it that you see here now. Also, there was Dr. Everett Chandler, who was a member of the Santa Lucia chapter of the Sierra Club, but retired dean of students at Cal Poly University. They really wanted to get people with name recognition and people that bring some expertise to the committee, and I think all these people did that. Oh, well, then, of course, there's John Evans, who was the county director and so forth. My area of expertise was in water quality management. And then there was Dr. R.L. Graves, who was a retired professor of architecture at Cal Poly. And his area of expertise or responsibility was wildlife habitat. And then there was Dr. Jim Horton, who was a professor, I believe it was Bakersfield City College, but also was a docent and a member of the Morro Bay Museum of Natural History and very, very involved in that organization. And just a tremendous job on putting together that PowerPoint presentation that you saw there. And then we had Ed Walder. Good old Ed was a member of the Coast Audubon, and Ed was very, very involved with many environmental groups, and wildlife and habitat management was his area of expertise. And then we had Reggie Falk. Reggie built so many bird boxes for us. So the county supplied the lumber, but Reggie supplied the expertise and the time and effort to build bird boxes. So this was the committee, and I tell you, it was a very fine committee to work with. Their charge was to bring or to obtain recognition as a sanctuary course for both Morro Bay and for Dairy Creek. And the committee and this group accomplished that, and we're very proud of it. I'd also like to recognize the staff. The staff was great on this. This program will not work unless you have the support and dedication of the staff. And Ray Festa, of course, Pete Jenny was, without his approval, it would never have gone. Ray Festa was really a great person to work with. We, as I say, I love working with people, but Ray and I have known each other for years, and it's just a real pleasure to work with him because he's very dedicated. And, of course, there's Tom Massey and Russ Kroc that are sitting back there. They're the ones that have the boots on the ground. We think up great ideas, and they have to get out and implement these ideas. And what I would like to say, I take a little more time than normal as usual, but what I would like to say, this program is a win-win situation because it pays for itself many times over. As you saw in the slide illustration, we reduce pesticides, we reduce irrigation, we reduce all these things. Well, to get these programs implemented, it takes hard work. And many supervisors say, I don't want to get involved. But once that work is accomplished and in place, a study done by the Audubon Group, International Audubon Group, says for every $1 of environmental effort, you get a $2.50 return. Less materials, less labor, and so forth. And then you end up with an environmental friendly golf course. And interesting, you saw the turkeys, you saw the birds, you saw the deer. You know, strolling Morro Bay and Derry Creek is something more than a golf course. It's just a marvelous, marvelous scenery out there on both courses. And then to see all this animal life and so forth that have developed out there. So it's been a win-win situation and certainly one that I've been very happy to work with. One other point I want to make. This is an international Audubon effort. It has no connection with Audubon. Audubon are good people, and I'm sure that most of them will support this, but it's not an Audubon effort. It's the name that it was chosen for an international program called International Audubon, but has no real connection with our local Audubon and so forth. Thank you.
Thank you, and it's really good to see you again and see you in such good – it's me talking. It's really good to see you again and see you in such good health.
I have a real hearing problem, so I've got to come closer to you.
I said it's really good to see you again and see you in such good health.
Oh, yes, thank you. Thank you very much.
And I'd like to thank staff. I do have, you know, for all of the good work that you have done, I have one suggestion. You take this program to the advisory committees in the county. It would mean 11 nights, but... I think it would be a really good outreach.
The intent of this program is we now take it on the road. We have actually shown it to all of our local golf clubs, and John's intent and my intent is now to take it to the various civic clubs, and we're pretty much open to invitations, and I think this would appeal to a lot of civic groups, and our job now is to get the word out.
Okay. Thank you.
Ray,
thank you very much.
Would you please reintroduce the gentleman in the back and have them stand up and so we recognize them?
Yes. Tom and Russ. Tom Massey, supervisor at Morro Bay Golf Course. Russ Croc, supervisor at Derry Creek Golf Course.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thank you again.
Thank you. Yes, please.
Thank you. I would just like to commend Parks and the Resource Committee, also the golf course staff for engaging in this program. And one question for either Ray or Pete, are there other private golf courses in the county that you are aware of that are following this example?
Yes, there are. The Cypress Ridge Golf Course in Napomo is also in the program and is fully certified. That particular golf course was designed to meet the criteria of this program from the get-go. Chalk Mountain Golf Course in Atascadero is enrolled in the program. They have not yet reached certification. And now that we've reached certification at Derry Creek, we can provide some effort and some direction and help them along the way, too. But most every golf course in the county is enrolled in the program. Then you have to go through a multi-step process to get certified, and that's where the real work is. But, yeah, I think all the golf courses embrace the concept and are, you know, willing to participate.
Great. Well, thank you for your leadership. And I do know golf courses are often used by others for purposes other than golf. So
exactly.
They do provide other benefits. And thank you all.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Oh, I have no more lights up here. So with that, we will close the presentation section and move on to public comment. I have two requests to speak forms. The first is Michael Kovacs, and the second is Jesse Arnold. So if you'd like to go to respective microphones.
Thank you. I'm Michael Kovacs, one of the unincorporated citizens, residents, property owners who are paying all kinds of taxes, many of the 1,000 county fees and taxes. First, I'm smiling ear to ear because 2 hours ago, this morning, the great success in launching our space shuttle Discovery. Hoorah, hoorah to NASA and everybody who is working on that project. I am proud for having worked on this project from inception to completion. 3 years ago, here, we weren't smiling when Columbia's tragedy occurred. I am astounded that despite of the tragedy, we have been still going on to try it again. I keep my fingers crossed during the following 2 weeks when they are coming back down. I hope successfully and safely. The second item I'd like to talk to you about, the cuts in public services, where it hurts the most, the public. A month ago, I have an article in my hand. Again, a month ago, you have made cuts in the nonprofit organization support quite a bit. Here are those, I don't know, dozens of kind of nonprofit organizations. You have, again, rubber-stamped another one of staff's recommendations in order to balance the budget. In case you aren't aware of your board, there are other means to balance budgets, not only cutting the services, but also by cutting expenditures, like we did for 40 years, and it's continually being done in corporate America. Haven't you heard of Hewlett and Packard and Springs and other PG&E corporations? Their managements are representing the shareholders. You are supposed to represent us, your constituents.
Thank you for your comments. Jesse Arnold, followed by Steve Matthew.
Thank you, Chairman Bianchi and members of the board. My name is Jesse Arnold. I live in Cambria. I'm here to talk about myth number 5 regarding genetic engineering. There are a lot of myths about genetic engineering. Number 5 is that genetic engineering will help hungry people in the third world. And the main myth under this category that I've found is the myth of golden rice. A Swiss scientist learned that people in the third world were subsisting only on rice, very poor people. They could only eat rice. So he had the idea of designing a rice with vitamin A in it, and he succeeded in genetically engineering beta-carotene into the rice, and that's why it has its golden color, and came up with golden rice. And the proponents of genetic engineering have been saying for the last couple of years, oh, this is helping people in the third world. The only trouble is that isn't true. The third world has not accepted golden rice. It has never been planted or used in the third world, so it isn't helping anyone in the third world. And I think one of the reasons is the message that golden rice sends is, here we are. This Swiss scientist got $2 million from the Rockefeller Foundation to develop it. And so here we are in the rich countries. We spent $2 million to design a rice so that you can go on subsisting on a diet of only rice. Our goal should be to have these people have a balanced diet. And the way you do that is raise their income level so they can afford a balanced diet, or help them to gain access to land so they can grow the food to have a balanced diet. So next time you hear someone bragging about the wonders of golden rice, please remember to take their talk with a very large grain of salt. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Jesse. Steve Matthew? And that's my last request to speak for him. So.
Chair and board, Steve Matthew, AGP Video, current operators of the house system here and resident of San Luis Obispo County. Though you haven't been seeing me here that much, personally, I actually am here a lot in the background. One of the reasons I wanted to address you here today is I am running an experiment with streaming. This meeting is currently being streamed worldwide, so let's get our ties straight. however, with the new government center security system, you are not actually able to view it here in the building. You could view it anywhere else in the world. IT will hopefully address that so that these meetings and other meetings that I do, and the reason that I'm not here a lot is that I'm out working all over the state, video streaming all of the Department of Resources meetings that are recorded, such as the Fish and Game Commission, which is going to be here on August 17th and 18th. And all levels of the Marine Life Protection Act committees, and soon to be the Coastal Commission, many of which I'm certain that you would be interested in viewing yourselves if you were here. I do understand that it's just a matter of setting the parameters so that you will be able to view it. Also on that note, since this is my first trip to the podium in the new building, we have a good base system here. We're doing AGP video. And the crew is doing everything that it can to provide the best production possible. We are experiencing, however, some shortfalls with regards to original design equipment and some engineering. Hopefully, we'll be able to get those things squared away so that we can produce at the highest possible level. One of the things that's still occurring is we're still bicycling tapes from here over to Charter after the meeting and to put them in 5 or 7 year old tape decks to try and play back on channel 21. All of that could be played back from this location on hard drive if we had some equipment that kind of got left off the list. So any assistance that we could get from any direction to help kind of tidy this up as quickly as possible, I'd sure appreciate it because it's causing me to go gray much too fast. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments, Steve.
If I could, real quick. Bob reminds me, I didn't even give the website. It's currently viewable at both of our websites, slo-span.org, slowspan.org, big button right at the top of the page that says live webcasts, or our new site that's statewide, CalSpan, CAL-SPAN.org.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Matt. That was my last request to speak form, so we will...
Madam Chair?
One coming up.
Peggy.
Thank you, Madam
Chair. If you could turn in your...
Yeah. I shall. Peggy Wilson Oceano. I have just arrived, and I would like to say that I rise to address you. Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the board, staff, council. Peggy Wilson Oceano. I'm here to say that you just heard from one of my official heroes. Steve Matthew has contributed more to this community and the state and its awareness of public information matters than any of us or perhaps all of us put together might realize at this moment. And I'm very, very, very proud to call him my friend. And I am very, very proud that my Board of Supervisors has had the long-running, ongoing, ever-deepening relationship with AGP Video that it has. It has done such a service to us all. And the people of the state of California, and apparently the people of the world, are now going to be the happy and lucky beneficiaries of the brilliant mind of Steve Matthew, who is backed by an equally brilliant mind of Nancy Castle. So thank you. Every time I turn on AGP Video, I thank you.
Thank you, Peggy. We always like to have good comments like that. So I see no one else coming forward, no other request to speak forms. So I will close the public comment period. We'll move on to the consent agenda. I have one request to speak form for the consent agenda, Michael Kovacs.
Thank you. Well, I have been seeing very often during the past many years such amendments to previously let contracts. This one is by the Public Works Director who let this contract on a fixed price basis, or no, I'm sorry, it was not expressly fixed price. so that it can be amended, adjusted, increased later. So this contractor got this contract. I'm talking about as my case in point. Which case is going on, all has been going on all the time in this county. They led it to the lowest bidder, knowingly that the difference between the upper bidder can be made up in purchase order changes and contractual changes like this one, from $920,000 to $1.1 million in consulting fees regarding for a simple road project, blacktop road project, not a high-tech contract. Why the so-called unforeseen events necessitates such adjustments and amendments? It doesn't smell good to me. I think this has been just another way of ripping the public off, and you are letting this to happen year in, year out. Two things I would like to call your attention, board, is first, why not fixed price contracts for such simple, nothing profound projects? Why not? This is not like the space shuttle program we had. It was a cost-plus fixed-fee contract. Yes, because it was loaded with unforeseen, unpredictable cost requirements during the years and years of design and development, delivery, etc. project. This is a road project in an intersection someplace. I have no time to identify the place. It's ridiculous to me letting it out with cost plus fixed fee, which is the amendments. Amendment number one, and these consulting engineers aren't through yet with their project. There is one more year to go because the time has also been changed, allowed by the public works director to be changed for their convenience. I would like to call your attention, board members, please.
And Michael, your time is up.
I am sorry.
Okay. Thank you for coming in. With that, that was my only request to speak form on the consent agenda, so I will close it to the public. Mr. Ovett, do you have any items?
No items, Madam Chair.
Mr. Patterson?
No, Madam Chair.
Mr. Lenthal?
No, ma'am.
Mr. Ashajan?
Not at this time. Thank you, Madam Chair.
And I don't have any, but I would ask if Public Works would like to respond to any comments.
Looks like it's coming in still under budget.
My only comment is that we don't...
And your name?
My name is Glenn Pretty. I'm Deputy Director of Public Works. Consulting contracts are not low-bid contracts. The consultant is first chosen by his qualifications, and then price comes secondary. Although I'm not going to compare our projects to space shuttle, they are quite complex and unpredictable when we start them. They take a long time to develop, and especially because of a lot of the environmental type regulations and other regulations we have to follow, they are a moving target, and it's not uncommon for us to have to adjust the consultant's contracts as we go along.
Okay. Thank you for that explanation. With that...
We'll approve off the consent agenda items.
Second.
With the changes.
With any changes to the agenda, may we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Ashajan?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mr. Ovett?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
Aye.
Ms. Bianchi?
Yes. With that, we will move on to item... turn my page here. Item C1, may we have an introduction, please?
Item C1 is a hearing to consider upholding an appeal by Byron Grant and submittal of a resolution reversing the decision of the Subdivision Review Board and Conditional Approval Lot Line Adjustment COAL 03-0286 parentheses S030113L, for project located at 433 Carpenter Canyon Road across Highway 227 from the city of Arroyo Grande, 4th District. This item was continued from June 14, 2005. Recommend approval and instruct chairperson to sign.
Thank you. May we have a staff report, please?
Yes, good morning. Brian Pedrotti, staff planner. This is a request by Byron Grant for a lot line adjustment to adjust lot lines between three parcels of 4.60, 2.37, and 0.15 acres each. The adjustment would result in three parcels of 2.05, 2.54, and 2.53 acres each. The project is located at 433 Carpenter Canyon Road across Highway 227 from the city of Arroyo Grande. It is in the residential suburban land use category. The property is surrounded by rural residences and the residences of the city of Arroyo Grande. On December 6, 2004, the Subdivision Review Board heard and denied a proposal for a lot line adjustment to adjust the lot lines on this property. On June 14, 2005, the Board of Supervisors heard and upheld the appeal by the applicant of the Subdivision Review Board's decision. The board found that the property included three legal parcels and directed staff to return to the board with an environmental determination and conditions of approval. Staff has done that and has recommended approval of the lot line adjustment based on the findings listed in Exhibit A and the conditions listed in Exhibit B. And that concludes staff's presentation.
Thank you. Are there any questions of staff? I see no names appearing. So with that, I will open it to the public. Mr. Grant his agent has the opportunity to make a comment. Usually you get 10 minutes, but you don't really need to take it.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board, Tom Vaughn. Absolutely don't need it. We're here to answer any questions there may be.
I see no lights, no names, so apparently there are no questions. Thank you very much. Is there anyone else from the public who wishes to address the board on this item? I see no one, so I will close it to the public and bring it back to the board for discussion or action. District 4.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please?
Mr. Asajian?
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt?
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal?
Aye.
Mr. Patterson?
I would like to just quickly comment. I was not convinced during the original hearing that there were three original lots that existed, and I voted against it because of the precedent-setting nature of it, and so I will continue to vote no.
Mrs. Bianchi?
Yes. That concludes Item C1, we will move on to Item C2. May we have an introduction, please?
Item C2 is a hearing to consider an appeal by Mark Walper of a denial of a request to waive curb gutter sidewalk improvements for DRC 2004-00221 and submittal of a resolution affirming the decision of the Planning Director and Public Works Director disapproving the application. 4th District, recommend denial of the appeal and instruct chairperson to sign.
Yes, may we have a staff report, please?
Good morning, Chairperson, members of the board. Stephanie Fuse, County Planning. As it stated, this item is an appeal of a denial of a curb gutter sidewalk waiver request. The project is located on the corner of Beach Street and 22nd Street in the community of Oceano. Can you not hear me?
Is your mic pushed on? The green light down below?
It's on. I'm not leaning over far enough, I guess. The project is located in the residential multifamily land use category. The land use ordinance was amended in the year 2002 to address community concerns about providing curb gutter and sidewalk whenever feasible. Planning and Public Works staff reviewed the proposal and found that curb gutter sidewalk would be compatible and not cause drainage problems to adjacent properties. I have a couple slides of the project site. This is a view of 22nd Street looking north. And this is a view of the project site looking west on Beach Street. And there was curb gutter sidewalk installed last year, two doors down. With that, staff is recommending denial of the appeal based on the findings in Exhibit A, and we're available for questions.
Are there any questions of staff? Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm curious to know if the other lots in that area also, as they are being developed, are required to put in curb gutters and sidewalks.
Generally, this project and the neighboring properties are zoned residential multifamily, so we would require it for any new construction that there's an assessed value of 25% increase, and if it goes above that 25%, then they're required to put curb gutter sidewalk in.
Madam Chair, the yes. Public Works Department is also here and might be able to provide the board more information on that okay. also.
Thank you. Mr. Marshall.
Thank you, Supervisor Bianchi, members of the board. Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. I brought with me an exhibit that I'd like to put on the projector, and I don't think I've used this projector before, so indulge me a bit.
No. Yeah. Success.
Can I do anything else? Well, let's find out.
You can pull the microphone up closer to you.
Or undo it.
So this depicts, this is the project site. And the other locations that are highlighted in yellow have either already constructed or are being processed for the construction of curb gutter and sidewalk improvements within this block.
Okay. Thank you very much. That answered the question that I had yesterday. Yes.
Why, Mr. Marshall's there with that map up there. It seems to me in staff report, and it wasn't addressed, that one of their concerns was drainage. Can you speak to that?
Sure. The drainage pattern in this location is that drainage would flow south along 22nd Street, along the frontage of this site, and then turn the corner and continue west along Beach Street. And, pardon me, the profile of Beach Street is very flat. It's less than 1%.
But it does flow.
It does flow, such as it is. Curbs and gutters will make it better once they're all in place. And as you can see from the exhibit, we're processing this, the construction on this block with that intent of completing that system.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Uh-huh. And you want to take your map back?
I'll need it for the record.
I'll send a copy to the clerk.
Thank you.
I see no other names popping up on my little computer here. So with that, I will open it to the public, and the applicant has the opportunity to make a presentation. Mr. Wampler.
My name is Mark Wampler, Oceano resident, and yes, I do. I also have some documentation I would like to step over here.
Okay, and you have 10 minutes total.
You can lift the mic if that's easier for you.
Okay. Thank you.
Take it apart.
Yeah, I'll just try and manage here somehow. Thank you for your patience. I'd like to address, first of all, the issue of drainage. As you know, about 3 years ago, there was a comprehensive study done. It was conducted a $100,000 budget drainage study in Oceano. I don't know if you can see the pattern here. Down 22nd, we see that the flow shows a direct southerly direction. And right at the corner of 22nd and Beach, you'll see that about halfway up the block, the flow reverses and comes back towards the corner and then proceeds downward. And also, in with this regard, this drainage study also proposed infrastructure. Excuse me, disorganized. And boy, oh boy, get that. If you can see this. Can you see this? Okay, I can zoom in a little bit. Okay, this depicts the zones that were outlined by this study. Down 22nd from just above Paso Robles Street calls for a subterranean drainage pipe to be installed with drop inlets at each corner, prospectively Paso Robles Ocean, Beach Street, and finally Highway 1. And it seems to me that this study, due to the nature of the scope of it, should be pretty authoritative as far as drainage goes. I have a letter from my neighbor who lives right across the street from the property, and he's unprotected. And this is one of the big issues in Oceano is those that are protected by a curb gutter and sidewalk many times do so at the peril of others that are not protected. And much of the runoff ends up in unprotected properties. In addition to that, our alleys have also, by default, have become catch basins. As our alleys run parallel to Highway 1, they have a way of catching the runoff, and thankfully that happens in order that our properties don't get flooded out. So we, the way the terrain works here in Oceano, starting anywhere from 25th Street to 24th and on down, the terrain just naturally leads right down to Highway 1. As you know, we make the papers every rainy season, storm season, where we get flooded out. And the presence of more and more concrete exasperates the problem that I have seen. And so I'd like for you to consider that. Here, by the way, is just, I'll hand this in. This is my friend Rudy. Lives across the street, and this is his statement here. Now, here's a statement. This is also page 3 off the website. Goals listed in the Oceano-specific plan adopted in the spring of 2002 also include developing a continuous system of sidewalks with gutters, providing a means to deliver larger quantities of water to collection points. Well, I agree, that's true. The collection points are, number one, our alleys and unprotected properties. I don't know of any catch basins that are part of a community drainage project because simply we do not have a community drainage system. And so, there again, referring back to the infrastructure and the subterranean drainage pipe, if we have curbs, gutters, and sidewalks without the drainage system, we are exasperating a problem. It is becoming increasingly worse as time goes by. We need a drainage system if we're going to have curbs, gutters, and sidewalks for all of Oceano. There's something else to consider with my particular project. And this is page 2 here, section, quoting parts of section 22-54-030. It says, a land use ordinance requires curb gutter and sidewalk to be installed for properties within residential multifamily land use category within urban reserve line when new construction exceeds 25% of the total value of all improvements on the site, or when a new structure is moved onto a site. Well, the $12,000 budget that I have for the purchase of my old mobile home hardly exceeds the 25% of the land value. While this is referring to new construction, according to this statement, when a new structure is moved onto the site, well, my structure is 29 years old. It's not a new structure. It is an old structure that is being moved onto this property. So the way that I read it, I believe this applies to a new structure that is to be moved onto the property. Therefore, the way that I read this, my particular project should not kick in at all this curb gutter and sidewalk ordinance.
You have 2 minutes and 40 seconds.
Okay, I think I can do that. Okay, I would like to compare, first of all, a project, project referrals to both the Oceano District, that'd be the Oceano Community Services District, and also the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee. And I would like to, first of all, demonstrate this that was unanimously approved by and signed by Chairperson Peggy Wilson. As you can see, the date is May 16th, 05. Here we have the same exact referral. However, you can see that there has been some superimposed information here, which I find somewhat alarming. I would like to read this, and this is signed by Mr. Philip Davis. In accordance with the direction from the Oceano Halcyon Committee and the Oceano Community Services District Board of Directors, we are recommending that all new construction projects be required to install curb gutter and sidewalks on their street frontage. This directly contradicts the findings of the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee, in which Chairperson Peggy Wilson and our committee members, of which I did abstain, I am a member at large, I did abstain from that voting, and that it was passed unanimously. So I consider this document here not to be valid whatsoever. This is not true, okay? And I have no idea how this was arrived. The dates have been changed, and it seems to me to be a spurious document altogether. Okay, that sums up what I have to say. Thank you.
Thank you for your comments. I have no request to speak forms. Is there anyone from the public who wishes to address? I wish you'd turn in your request to speak forms ahead of time so I know.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Peggy Wilson, my apologies. We will make certain that the clerk has this request to speak form. Peggy Wilson, Oceano, and I'm here to speak to you in both capacities, and because I am speaking as a private citizen and also as the president of the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee, I would ask, Madam Chair, that you grant me limited latitude, if you would, please, so that I can begin my comments by correcting some errors in your board's packet. In your transmittal letter, you will notice that in terms of other agencies, that the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee is not listed there. We did, in fact, and indeed, as evidenced in your packet, address this issue, and I would respectfully request that the record be amended and corrected to reflect that the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee did, in fact, comment in detail on this. As far as the OCSD's project referral, perhaps Mr. Davis is busy and unaware of the committee's very well-voiced position with regard to curbs, gutters, and sidewalks. And Mr. Davis, being not a member of the Oceano Halcyon Advisory Committee, is not authorized to speak for us. It is a mistake. The committee has not recommended denial of this waiver application. And in fact, the committee asks that you all deal with it as we do now on a case-by-case basis. For some reason, the OCSD gets their project referrals well ahead of ours. We don't know, but ours came too late for us to be heard and respond at the time that the OCSD was able to respond. Again, it's a mystery we're still trying to unravel. The problems with the curb, gutter, and sidewalk ordinance are perhaps pitting ideological desires for the community against practical desires. And its impacts exacerbate flooding, and they create impediments to pedestrian traffic. Perhaps worse, they impose financial burdens on families that effectively prevent them and has prevented and is preventing many properties from being refurbished and made happy the way we'd like to see them. And with all due respect to staff, the hodgepodge imposition of curbs, gutters, and sidewalks has actually added to our drainage problems in several ways, especially in the loss of permeable soils. We heard Mr. Marshall say that this will all be better in this neighborhood once these are in place. However, they're not in place, and they're far from being there. And we would like to take this opportunity to reiterate the community's desire to have this issue dealt with on the basis of what's practical and fair. And I speak for many Oceano homeowners when I tell you that we are concerned about what appears to be an unequally applied imposition of requirements not imposed on other unincorporated communities around the county.
And your time is up.
If you would give me another 30 seconds, Madam Chair, since Mr. Wampler seems
to... Can you put in 30 seconds? Okay.
Thank you, ma'am.
That's it.
I'd like to reiterate, this doesn't seem to be imposed upon other county unincorporated communities in this way, and it gives a feeling of an us versus them dynamic between staff and those of us in the community. So perhaps Mr. Marshall would like to accept my invitation and come out and get to know some of us in the community and perhaps get a refreshed perspective and get to know us personally, and certainly any and all of you are thanked for your time. We thank staff for their time, and Mr. Marshall and his staff are always invited to the OHAC meeting. Okay. And thank you very much, Madam Chair, for the 30 seconds.
You're welcome. I have no other request to speak forms at this point, so that leaves nothing for Mr. Wampler to rebut. I mean, if you would like to make a final statement, you have a minute, and then I will bring it.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My grandparents came to Oceano in the 1940s, and I've been here since the 1960s, graduated from Rio Grande High School. And so I'm as local as you can get. And I like to see Oceano be preserved in a way that's in character with our community. Yes, we've got new blood. We've got new people moving in. But the character needs to stay. And I think we need to, as Peggy pointed out, to look at this issue realistically. I don't believe that the ordinance, the mandatory sidewalk ordinance, is a one-size-fits-all program. It can't work for Oceano. It can in time. Assessment districts are a good idea, even if it can be done one block at a time, where everybody can have a sidewalk, can be done in an expeditious way where it's affordable. And I'm all in favor of assessment districts that can be had in good manner. Thank you. I'm out of time.
Thank you. With that, I'll close it to the public. Bring it back to Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have a quick question for staff, and that's regarding Mr. Wampler's comment about the drainage collection system that was pointed out in the flood study for Oceano. What's the status of that?
Richard Marshall, Department of Public Works. The study recommends, as the long-range improvement for the community, a combination of a storm drain system and a complete network of curbs, gutters, and sidewalk, well, curbs and gutters, really, for drainage. There isn't any program in place for implementing that yet. Pardon me. Co-workers of mine in the department have been working with the community and with your board to identify mechanisms for implementing the study's recommendations, but none have been created at this point. curbs, gutters, and sidewalks can be installed consistent with the recommendations of that study and do not preclude the ability to implement the rest of its recommendations later when a mechanism is identified.
Okay. When you evaluate particular sites, do you actually look at whether or not it exacerbates flooding problems downstream? Is that one of the considerations?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay. I just want to make one quick comment. I have seen programs of this nature, both
with streets. Are you through with your questions from?
Yes, I am, Richard. Thank you. I've seen programs where cities and the county has required the installation of curbs and gutters and also streets and developments that are unpaved. And as the community, as the neighborhoods get developed, these need to go in. And if the programs aren't administered consistently, what you end up with is a patchwork of unpaved streets versus paved segments and curbs and gutters that are intermittent. And I think it's very important that if we are ultimately going to achieve the goals in the neighborhoods that we want, that we do bite the bullet and require that these improvements be installed. So I think we need to do that. And if staff is evaluating it so it doesn't exacerbate flooding problems downstream, that it is a program that we ought to support.
Mr. Shajan, followed by Mr. Ovett.
Thank you, Madam Chair. There were some comments made by Mr. Wempler. I want to respond to that, and I stand to be corrected if staff will correct me. The 25% total value of improvement, I believe that was put in place if somebody was to remodel their existing home and the value went beyond the 25%, then a requirement will be to add a curb, sidewalk, gutter, correct?
That's correct.
And the other question he brought forward, that if the new structure is, could be any structure, a used one, coming to an unimproved land.
That's correct.
Okay. The other thing, Mr. Wambler, you brought forward that not other communities have this, and or one size doesn't necessarily fit all communities. I'll agree with you 100%, but this requirement came to us. We didn't sit here and put this ordinance in place. It came to us, and then at the advisory council did support it. We have new faces there today, including yourself, which you're welcome to it. And Oceano Community Service District supported the idea before I ever told anyone in Oceano that I will support it at this level here. So it did come to us because Oceano wanted to somehow clean up their street, put the sidewalks, and be equal to other communities and change the image or any which way you want to see it. But that request did come to us from the community for us to have supported that ordinance to be in place. We did not compare it to any other communities. We did what their wishes were at that time. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm ready to make a motion when you're ready.
Okay. Mr. Ovett?
I just want to clarify one thing. This misnomer that does not apply to all communities, it is, and I can personally attest to the fact that curb, gutter, sidewalk requirements are applied in all communities, not just in Oceano. So we're not just picking on Oceano.
But it became an ordinance because it came to us as a requirement.
Well, it's actually part of the construction ordinance to begin with because, for example, 8 years ago, I think, when I did my restaurant, I had to put in curb, gutters, and sidewalk, and I had over 25% improvement. In Templeton, we have it all the time. We do have the waiver procedure that in any of this same situation, people come in and improve the property, they are required to put these in. So it's a standard situation that's used, and I'm trying to think it's building code or where it's at. You, as an Oceano, may have required it in a building standard or in a community design.
That
it is there.
This was also an issue that was discussed during the specific plan as well for the community. Now, if we were in an area where maybe commercial and already built up and somebody doing a remodeling of some sort and this red flag goes on, I might be looking at it differently than when you have a street where it's already looks like a patchwork and the beauty is going to be for us to be able to make all fit with that. My apologies, Mr. Wampler. I'm not going to be able to support your appeal. Move denial of the appeal.
Second.
May we have a roll call, please? I'm daydreaming.
Mr. Asajian.
Aye.
Mr. Lenthal.
Aye.
Mr. Ovitt.
Aye.
Mr. Patterson.
Aye.
Mrs. Bianchi.
Yes. Okay, usually we take a break right about now, but we only have one more item left. Do the supervisors want to hear the next item, and then we're through with the morning's agenda before we take a break? So you guys make it short.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the board. Dwayne Leib, General Services Director. We have a short presentation for you this morning about a proposed new energy policy. As your board is probably aware, we submitted a budget item to you this year under General Services, which included a 10% reduction in utility costs. It's kind of a tall order, but in order to meet that 10% projection, we need your board to consider a policy that has some teeth in it. And this policy will affect all employees, namely the temperature settings within our county buildings will be most noticeable and affected. It'll affect some of their personal appliances like heaters and refrigerators, which we're recommending against. And if your board's aware that we have a central utilities budget in General Services, we've been talking with the county administrative officer to consider decentralizing and putting the responsibility for utilities within each department. Right now, there's really no incentive to turn off switches or reduce temperatures. One department pays the bill. And we'd like to have more direct accountability. So that will be an offshoot of this policy. Should your board adopt our policy today, we'll look into that for the future. And right now, I'd like to turn it over to David Clue. He is the County Utilities Coordinator within the Department of General Services. And David has a flip chart presentation for you. It's short. David?
Good morning, Madam Chairman, members of the board. The policy here, what we really want to do is reach some goals and objectives of saving about 10% of our utility bills. And we're going to do that through a series of strategies and tactics that revolve around some similar things to what we've done in the past and a couple of new things. So in the past, we've had great success with energy conservation, with distributed generation, our cogeneration plant across the street. In the future, we need to be looking more at demand reductions and renewable energies as a possible reductions in the future. And there's a number of reasons for all this. Just briefly, on renewables, they are among the best rebates in the industry right now. The utilities are moving away from the old traditional rebates for standard conservation items, and they're pushing more toward renewables, and this is at the direction of the state. So as the rebates move in that direction, it's important that we continue to move in that direction as well. In the past few years, we've brought in somewhere in the order of $600,000 in rebates for the county. So we want to continue to pursue that. Give you an idea how well we've done on conservation. The clearest chart, but you can see this is these blue line here is what our energy has been doing over the last couple of years, just in the government center alone. And you can see it's slowly growing. As we add people and equipment to buildings, we get a slow growth. But we've also it also shows the success we've had in conservation. Back in June of 2001, this is where our energy was, and we would have been following this upper yellow line if we hadn't been doing some of the things we did, like retrofitting the courthouse across the street. We added 60,000 square feet of air conditioning, and yet we were still able to reduce our energy use by a significant amount. With distributed generation, our cogeneration plant, you can see the results. The bottom line here is what we're producing electricity for. The blue line at the top is what the PG&E costs would be, and this yellow line in between shows the difference between the two. The space between the yellow and the blue lines here is really what we're saving each year or each month for installing this distributed generation plant. We want to do more of that type of thing where it applies and makes sense. Demand reduction is a little different. Demand reduction is an area that the PUC is forcing the utilities to move toward where they would be charging more for peak hours during afternoons, noon to 6. In commercial buildings, we're charged two pieces instead of the one that a residential is charged. We're not only charged for kilowatt hours like you are in a home, but we're also charged for kilowatts for the amount of power we draw at any one time. And that's what the demand component is. And we need to have strategies in place that will help us reduce those when the state calls on us to reduce them. When there's a shortage of power in the state, we need to be able to respond to that one way or another. We can either respond by reducing our energy use during that time, or we can pay more money. What we want to do is stay away from paying more money. Give you an idea how much more. This shows you an idea of how much demand charges can change in the partial peak period. This is $2.65 per kilowatt. And then when we get into peak hours in the summer afternoons, it goes as high as $11.80. As a matter of fact, for this past month, for June, we paid $13.80 per kilowatt for most of our buildings that have a demand component. The PUC has come up and ordered the utilities to come up with plans for assuming this critical peak pricing. We've been successful this year in delaying it until 2006, but it will affect us in 2006, in which case there's going to be 10 to 12 days in summer where these higher rates kick in, and we need to be prepared for that. Utilities have opposed this. They don't like the idea of this, but at the same time, in order for us to be able to meet the energy needs in California, they need a program like this in place that will shift peak away. Give you an idea how much the additional cost is. This shows residential, but it gives you a pretty good idea. The green line across here is the average rate that we pay. What they're going to do is during certain hours a year, about 75 hours per year, the rates will be this kind of a number, 73 cents. And they're going to make up for that during the off-peak hours by lowering costs during off-peak hours. Unfortunately, we're a government agency, and we don't operate during the off-peak hours. We operate in the middle of it all, so we would only see this higher price, and we wouldn't be getting the price break. On the commercial side, those numbers are very similar. See, during normal peak periods, we pay almost 19 cents a kilowatt hour, and we're going to be paying as much as 82 cents a kilowatt hour. A significant increase for those 6 hours during the day. To get there, we've got a number of goals and strategies. We want to reduce our energy use by 10%, prepare for the critical peak pricing, and increase our independence and diversity of our energy sources. Do it by strategies, mandatory requirements, changes in the way we purchase equipment and products that use energy, project funding to make sure that a project is able to implement energy conservation techniques and not run out and shorten those purchases because we run out of money on a project. Also, measurement tools so we can tell where we are and where what kind of improvements we're actually seeing. Today, we don't really know our real use for energy in any particular situation. We are now buying some tools that will allow us to do that. In a similar way is the financial system is allowing us to take a look at where we're spending money today. Whereas a few years ago, we had no idea, or not great ideas, on where the detailed spending was. This will help us in an energy accounting basis in a similar manner. Some of the tactics that would be involved in that would be thermostat settings, eliminating energy-intense personal items like under-the-desk heaters. A person using some of these items might use as much power as their own cubicle or their own office. Any office on either side of them triples their use. So we want to make sure that type of thing gets eliminated. Life cycle decisions when we're purchasing equipment. We want to make sure that we know what the true cost of that equipment is, including its energy cost over its lifetime, and not just the upfront cost, not just the upfront purchase cost, but include the energy and the maintenance cost in that as well. Adopting Energy Star is a standard when we're purchasing equipment. Appliances that meet the Energy Star symbol and their standards are much more energy conservative than other equipment, and so we want to adopt that as a basis to help people make some nice, clear decisions, easy decisions in purchasing energy equipment. Conservation hurdle funding. This is funding that will be in the budget for next year already. It's within our projects, and it's to help us to make sure that we're able to implement all these conservation items that we see when we're reviewing plans and building new buildings or retrofitting buildings, get that part of it done, and the energy accounting software, which will allow us not just to see what our bills are, but be able to flag when something's going wrong, suddenly there's an increase in energy use in a building, it will show it to us. It'll also help us pay our bills electronically, which will speed up the process and reduce some labor costs. Tactics, a number of tactics. There's many, many things we've come up with that we can approach, and we're going to be attacking all of these over a period of time, not all at once. But let me just point to a few things. Eliminating T12 fluorescent lighting, that would be a capital type improvement. There still are some older fluorescent lights in the buildings that we have. This would reduce our energy use for lighting, which is about 40% of our energy use in buildings. Consolidating refrigerators and replacing older models. Same types of things that the utilities have been encouraging homeowners to do, we want to do throughout our buildings. We have a number of those types of equipment around. And very important, increase employees' involvement in conservation. I want to make sure that the employees are able to voice their opinions and come up with ideas in various areas. And I'll be putting some educational materials out for employees to help train them and get some feedback from them on what they feel they can do in their area to help us reach this 10% goal. Do I have any questions from you?
And you completed your...
That's
okay. Yes, Mr. Patterson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Just a couple of quick questions. I think it's good that you're involving the employees. I mean, I think they're critical to the success or failure of this program, and we need to engage them at every level. Is there a timeline for the implementation of these various tactics and programs?
Well, we're going to implement them as the year goes on, picking the most important ones first. The timeline would be over this fiscal year to reach the 10%.
And you're looking for a 10% annual reduction?
10% annual reduction.
Do you have targets for the critical peak pricing that might be higher?
No. For critical peak pricing, really the intent is to have a plan in place so that when we do get called, we're able to respond and not have to pay those higher prices. And that's going to take probably a good 6 months to be able to put together that detailed plan, because every department, every area has different operational requirements, and we want to make sure that we're not going to get in the way of those operational requirements while we do this. For instance, if we ask them to reduce load, it might be a simple matter of just turning off a few lights here and there, which would lower our building demand. But in other areas, it may be that may affect their operation. So we want to make sure that whatever we do, whatever we come up with for specific plans for each areas, we can implement and not have a loss because of it.
I know when AB 939 was adopted, I think in 1990-1991, which dealt with resource reduction and waste diversion, many jurisdictions actually adopted purchasing policies that would allow greater expenditures up to 10% or so for things that would, well, they were made from recycled products to create a market for diversion of materials or buy products that reduced waste. Are we going to see a purchasing policy that might allow us to spend more for equipment that will give us greater savings in energy and money over time? Will we need to look at that?
I feel you do. That's what the $70,000 or so that's been budgeted this year is intended to do, to fill the void where we were going to make a purchase. It's prohibitive because of budget purposes for that particular project, and that money can be moved over to help that be accomplished. That's the idea of that.
Thank you.
Supervisor Patterson, if I could interject. We already have a policy where we can choose for life cycle costs. The refrigerators purchased for this building, for instance, cost a little bit more, but they're all Energy Star rated. So we plan on doing that. The most immediate effect, I think, that people are going to feel is we're going to put a lot of effort into resetting thermostats immediately. And summertime thermostats will be set at 75. We tend to intend on using a winter setting of 68. And I think as we achieve this, you will start to feel it in your atmosphere.
In the 75, I'm really happy with having had blue fingernails from freezing to death now for many years.
I would say that this building has presented quite a bit of a challenge because it's brand new and it's very complex.
Well, the old building, because the thermostat for my office was in Harry's. So.
Okay, now we know who caused the coldness.
Mr. Lenthal, do you have a question for these gentlemen?
Well, yes.
Or just a comment?
Probably both.
Okay.
One of my first questions is, I didn't see in this staff report, do we participate in anything similar to what state agencies do? I'm going to use Cal Poly as an example. When we get to certain level alerts where the state grid system is in short supply of power, that we automatically shut down or go to a higher level?
We don't currently, but that would be part of what this, the critical peak pricing demand plan would be, so that we can participate in that type of thing.
Because I am aware, when I was a city employee, that they adopted that a couple of years ago, and they found that there was some substantial savings in that, because when you look at the difference of what you're paying per kilowatt hour, it's exponential or logarithmic. So I was curious to that.
In the past, we haven't, because the economics hasn't driven it as hard. We put our effort in other areas. But because of the critical peak pricing plan, it's now very economic to be able to reduce that in the afternoon. So we'll be.
Thank you. My other question is, after reviewing this, it appears to me that there's a minimal, if any, flexibility for employees that work in either unique workstations or where we have a situation, especially in a building as complicated as this, to where we are not able to adequately regulate through the existing thermostat or control systems we have to ensure that our employees are working in that 75 to 68 degree window. And I was curious, if we adopt this ordinance and lock ourselves into that, what are we going to do, or what would department heads do, or managers do, in unique situations where you have an employee that, for sake of discussion, needs that little space heater in order to have a productive work environment? And I would like to see that incorporated somewhere in here, because I'm all for saving energy. Don't get me wrong, I want to do this. But I don't want to go down a road of saving energy and lose sight of the fact that we might put some people in certain workstations in an environment where they are less productive, which in the scheme of things cost us more money. And so I didn't see that built into the plan here.
We can certainly add language. It's my intention to take each exception on a case-by-case basis and work with the individual department head and the employee to see what we can and cannot do to accommodate. Your point's well taken. We have larger zones than one individual employee. So if we have a problem, we may have to give it some special consideration.
And I think the reality, and when you get a building this size, that there might be situations where, regardless of what the intents were with the design or the capabilities of the system, that you will have a unique situation where somebody says, no matter what we do, we can't get this particular workstation up to 68 degrees, and I need this, you know, auxiliary heater or a hot spot or something, where someone would say, I'd sure like to have a fan because it makes my workstation a little more productive. Can we get that language in there? Dwayne, I guess is what I'm asking.
We'd have to come up with something, but we certainly can put it in there. I'd like what you're talking about is a special exemption in a special case. And we'd have to look at it on a case-by-case basis. I would certainly like to give staff the opportunity to try to adjust or address an individual complaint to see if there's something that we could do mechanically within the system. And you should be aware that all the thermostats report to a central control, so we can get readouts and we can pretty much tell which zones are hot or cold.
I can see the temperature in every room in this building, for instance, at my desk.
I like that one. They can tell somebody's hot or cold.
So once you got up to 85 in my room the other day, the air conditioning did finally come on.
Well, I recognize there's a lot of issues, especially in a new complex building, but I just would like to see some flexibility for either the individual department heads or managers at those levels that are going to be able to say, no, we're locked into this ordinance that says we will not do anything to try to improve the quality.
Well, if we could just add a sentence that exceptions to the policy will be investigated on a case-by-case basis between the affected department head and the general services director.
Okay. Mr. Edge.
Madam Chair, it's important, and the reason that it's coming to the board is that if it's going to work, we've spent a lot of time talking about it, if it's going to work, then we need to have the board leading the process and saying, yes, this is important to us, and David has touched upon the amount of money we're talking about potentially in savings, and I think it's only going to get larger as energy costs continue to increase for the foreseeable future. I'd be a little reluctant to incorporate too much wiggle language into this policy. I think the danger of taking Supervisor Lenthal's comments to that logical extreme is essentially we develop a policy that says you can't use these kind of personal convenience items unless it's personally convenient to you. And I don't think we really want to go there. So I know quite a number of employees who would say, I need to have my personal heater or I need to have my personal cooler. And there's really no good reason other than that's what I'm used to having. And I think that we would, if we're going to have a policy rather than write some very liberal language in there that gives people a lot of flexibility, I think we start off with a pretty severe policy. And as Dwayne suggested, if there's a good medical reason why you need some particular device, then that certainly is understandable. And if there is an occasional unusual set of circumstances, as Supervisor Lenthal outlined, perhaps there's one particular workspace that, because of its geography or physical location, is problematic, then we can make that sort of exception. But I don't know that we need to develop a lot of language, because this isn't, we're not talking about an ordinance here, we're talking about a policy, a general policy that the board's adopting, and we've always traditionally in those kind of policies adopted a case-by-case review and when the circumstances warrant it.
Does that conclude your...
That was
okay. Mr. Patterson, followed by Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Are these questions or comments, by the way?
Well, question to Mr. Leib.
Letting you guys sit down.
Regarding Mr. Lenthal's comments and Mr. Edge's comment, is there a mechanism in place where if there were special circumstances, we could be confident that employees would have the ability to discuss that with their department heads and deal with them individually without including it in the policy per se?
I think it's really a matter of them bringing it up to their department head and discussing it with me. If you want to have a central control, we could make it subject to approval by the county administrator. I always like his involvement. But I don't see that it's hard and fast. As you say, it's not an ordinance, it's a policy.
Okay. With that in mind...
Well, Mr. Lenthal has a comment.
Okay. I'm prepared to move approval when we get to that point.
Mr. Lenthal.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My comments weren't to water down any type of existing policy or send anything but a strong message that we need to adopt ways of conserving energy. My concern was based on if we have a specific workstation that because of the logistics, because of a variety of factors, was not able to work within that 75-degree range in the summer, 68-degree range in the heater, would these employees be able to use some auxiliary methods? That's all I wanted to, I wasn't trying to do anything else. And you've assured me of that, Dwayne, and so that answers my question.
I think they kind of do that now. The key to it is that they don't do it independently, that they get some pre-approval and oversight over their actions.
And it might even be as simple as adjusting this central computer.
Yes.
Okay. Mr. Patterson?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I move that we adopt the energy policy as recommended by General Services.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Yes.
Aye.
Any opposed? Hearing none, that's our new policy.
Thank you.
Thank you. With that, we will move on to public comment on closed session. I have one request to speak for, Mr. Snyder. Let's go back.
Good afternoon. My name is John Snyder. I've come to talk about the Santa Maria groundwater litigation. And I apologize for short notice, but I was unable to get appointments with any of you guys before the hearing. It's never a good idea to sign in a hurry. I think you guys may have considered an earlier agreement, but nothing's been posted on the website, so you haven't officially signed anything. And I know that there's another version of an agreement in this litigation circulating around. The county now has only been being sued by NCSD, which has two claims, and I don't think any of those actually apply to the county. You're not pumping any water, and any claim of prescription doesn't apply to a government agency because there's no statute of limitations. So there's no actual claims for the county to settle in an agreement. NCSD will be required to outline what's left in the litigation on about September 9th, so the county at that time could see what NCSD thought was left to litigate. The agreement has a sub-agreement between Napomo and Santa Maria that is basically an agreement to agree, The county should not be pre-agreeing to an unknown future agreement that's likely to have limitations for water use for commercial uses. Santa Maria has had a policy of not selling water for commercial use down in Orcutt, and I believe they plan to extend that, and that would prohibit the funding for a future city of Napomo by not allowing, say, large shopping centers like they were planning down in Orcutt to be built. NCSD and Santa Maria have had about a year to resolve this actual sub-agreement that has the agreement to agree, and they still haven't agreed. I think the county would be agreeing to circumvent the two NCSD votes against paying for state water. I don't necessarily agree with those votes, but the votes exist. There's considerable land in the South County that's in the Santa Maria Valley. There's about 10,000 acres. In this agreement, landowners in the South County of SLO will be effectively selling water to Santa Maria and Cal Cities for less than $20 an acre foot. Cal Cities, having a similar priority, will not have to buy water from Santa Maria to achieve similar reliability as Santa Maria, who had purchased the state water. That relieves Santa Maria of selling that to Cal Cities, making that a water available to sell to Napomo for $1,200 an acre foot. So by using a shell game, San Luis Obispo County farmers are getting $20 an acre foot, and people in the city of Napomo are paying $1,200. I don't think that's a good thing for Napomo. There has been some possible conflicts of interest problems with the Santa Maria Valley Water Conservation District Board of Directors, which are the people who operate Twitchell Dam, when they signed the deal, and those are, I think, there's an ongoing concern there in San Luis Obispo County, because San Luis Obispo County did not have representation during that vote.
And Mr. Snyder, your time is up.
Okay. I recommend not signing the deal. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you for your comments. With that, that concludes our morning session. We will be going into closed session at, 11 o'clock? That gives us about 13 minutes. And we will return at 2 o'clock. Thank you very much.
Closed session at 11? Yes.